A polar bear in Paris in the middle of the French Revolution, well, that just has to be crazy, if not wrong. But it's a crazy period, so it's a good thing to let's check out that polar bear in Paris, and it'll either prove that the sources are wrong, or if we dig deep enough, that will give us a real flavour for the craziness of history tying itself in a knot during this period. So it was a wild period, 1789 to 1795, when Napoleon came in, and then 10 years before Napoleon declared himself emperor. So there's a sort of a mad couple of years, about 6 years of pretty insane stuff going on in France. And of course, this is Peter Hill Explains, and I'm on the track of Lamarck. So if you are in a test, 99% of the schools, if you said, or who came up with the theory of evolution, you would circle several options, and everyone would give the option Charles Darwin, because we all know he came up with evolution. But to be more precise, he came up with a mechanism of evolution called natural selection. This is survival of the fittest, used by various methods for various political causes, and you could call a dogma. It's a fairly well established law of natural selection. But if you said he came up with evolution, you'd have to be say, well, it's hard to difficult to put it to you. You're wrong. So a good, more perhaps 80 years before Darwin, easily 80 years before Darwin, a French person, Lamarck, came up with evolution, and he sailed the stormy seas of an incredible turmoil in the French Revolution, but he was kicked out and down, and he could read and use the flavour of the French Revolution to put forward the establishment of a natural history museum or institute, which would teach the masses. He sort of came and did wonders there, and this institute, amongst other things, was a repository of all the various animals that were hanging around Paris, including a polar bear. Now, of course, when I read this from one source, a more, I suppose, easy reading source on Lamarck, I'll go into that, I thought, there's a few things I'm sceptical of. So I just kept mental notes of things that I was sceptical of. And as you do, and you take the positive parts of a good coherent story, but you file things away. So there is a story of basically a menagerie, which is the term for a royal collection of animals, exotic animals, and that was held at Versailles when Versailles was stormed. We've got different stories coming out that when Versailles was stormed by the mob, they broke down the walls and these wild animals fled and were eventually captured and rehoused. But it didn't include a polar bear, so we've got to find out where the polar bear is. And in general, my sense is if you follow the animals are basically a constant witness to the turmoil of the times, and a witness to what people thought and believed. So I'm going to try and go back, looking at where these menageries came from and how they came up, and the other aspects of how that polar bear got onto the streets of Paris, eventually was housed in this chateau, a garden I'd like to visit at some stage. It looks fantastic to go. It looks so classical. And it went, and the stories are that a lot of the French Revolution sort of just ran out of steam, and everyone began to starve in 1795 when Napoleon came in, and including a lot of the animals. So that's you know, pretty fascinating stuff. Australia's just discovered in 1770, and the first convicts arrived in 1788. So this is on the, this is the French Revolution's in full swing, just around the around these times, sort of a year after. So menageries. So what is the menagerie? What did it look like in Versailles? So essentially, it's a building with, I think, well, just from a quick view of the map, about well, seven triangular fields, or it must be eight triangular fields going around it. And the size of, I suppose, small soccer fields, and animals would be allowed to go in that that space, and there were different lions and exotic things for the amusement of g'day mate, for the amusement of courtiers and favoured guests. So special people, special guests would get viewings at a particular time, and so it's all sort of like a high profile zoo. And then you've got the mythical aspect of animals linked to the mythical power of kings. So this stretched a long way back in history. Now, I'm going to mention a few things. So I've just quickly read about menageries. The book I read really has to be corrected, because they said, oh, look, Versailles, they were basically off their face, and indeed they were off their face. They had their long canal, and they had Venetian gondolas going down the canal, and they had a fake peasant village, and they were basically Louis XVI was party oriented, slightly dislocated. It sounds to me, if we had it nowadays, we'd suspect them of being on a lot of drugs. So there must have been some sort of drugs and madness and dislocation going in, probably too many people advising and not enough people thinking their way through. So the original book I read, which was Lamarck's Evolution, a very, very good read, suggested that the menagerie was actually put together by the court, but it's actually got a history which goes far, far further back. And if you have a quick read, you see that menageries were from 800 AD or 900 AD, at the time of Charlemagne, and the big kings used to keep basically animals, powerful animals, and they would be given powerful animals. So the animals would be, have a, in the Middle Ages, had a spiritual and mystic quality, and kings would trade them as powers and gifts. And so if you were given a gift of some leopards, or I think that's what Charlemagne was given, he had to have somewhere to put them. You just couldn't say, oh, well, thank you very much, and take them out the back and knock them off. You'd have them. And so the keeping of exotic animals, and later on for the upper class, it was the keeping of pedigree pets. So the keeping of a pedigree pet, or a lap dog, was seen a symbol of the upper class, a symbol of a royal, the royal animal. Of course, we have our Queen Elizabeth II with her corgis. We have carried on that tradition somehow with the corgis as a very successful symbol, symbol of state. But that the same is true there. And why I mention pedigree is, of course, come the Revolution, if you have a pedigree dog, which is not a working dog, it's a symbol of aristocracy. So there are reports that, along with the aristocrats getting a gruesome end, the pedigree dogs got a gruesome end, or they had to be made look like mongrels to survive. Or, you know, and of course, they've got the French poodle. That idea is still coming through from the idea of the aristocracy. democracy and wealth and richness and the lack of effective hard work. So if you want to say that you're a boss, the last thing you want to do is have sort of heavy hands and the signs of work. So you have a dog, which is not a sign of work. So the menagerie did exist, and it was built by the Sun King, Louis the 14th, I understand. And there's were two sort of working menageries in France, one at Versailles, another one at another place, beginning with V. I cannot pronounce it, so I'll spare you that. The one in the one not in Versailles was to keep exotic animals that were kept for show fights. So again, the symbolism there, the intense symbolism of being able to control animals and stage fights for entertainments between animals was a thing that the European kings did. It's like falconry, there's their relationships with animals as part of the mystical power of the medieval belief, the magical belief of kings. Their relationships with animals indicate that there, and you have, I'll say, a lot of rich people today have private zoos or want to own exotic pets for some reason or another. And I've always been fascinated by, as soon as I find out about a piece of history, in general, there's the bears, the ones that get trained to do various things, and I see if I can find out some information about the animal, because the animal is really, is there not due to choice, not because it's opted in to some sort of belief. It's really there as a function of some sort of the political views of the time. So in these cases, these animals were minding their own business and have been captured from the wild and given as gifts of power, status symbols. And I want to pause at the moment to talk about, so the French Revolution gave birth to the first research institute for the general value of the general use of the populace. And so Lamarck's genius was when he was shunned from an aristocratic science institution, he was able to create pamphlets and go in with the insane mood, tap into the insane mood at the time, and actually get this institute up and going, the Jardin des Plantes and various zoological and botanical institutes to keep on going. Now, the Jardin des Plantes was a botanic garden, so when it suddenly said, yes, we'll take the animals, there was no housing for it. And you can imagine there was a lot of chaos in the French Revolution. So let's go back and track those animals. I want to go right back to the first animals in the wild suddenly being shipped into humanity. So you can imagine a elephant saying, look, I've got to tell you, stay away from the humans. They'll get you doing crazy things like going into battle. They'll run burning pigs at you, and a whole heap of other things, and a giraffe saying to its giraffe, people, we've got a long neck, but mind you, that means that you are going to be zoo fodder forevermore. So when you see those Greeks, and I've got to say about the Greeks, have what we understand as the first scientific public zoological garden. And so what happened? So swapping back to Greeks, 360 BC, before Christ, BC as it's called, before the Common Era. Beautiful, beautiful translation there. Aristotle was a philosopher, and he was the mentor of Alexander the Great, the greatest conquest machine ever built. And there's, oh look, I could talk for a long time about Aristotle and Alexander the Great. But because of the idea that philosophy was a state function and necessarily shouldn't be paid, Aristotle refuse, as it's said, the accrual of direct wealth, of gold and triumph. And he said to Alexander the Great, send me back scientific samples. Now, Alexander the Great, not wanting to show off, but wanting to go things in excess, sent back all sorts of plants and animals to Aristotle, and he had and he was into classification, so he established a garden or a place for holding all these exotic animals, and this is really the first non-king oriented collection of animals, and so that stayed there for a while and gave back the basic way to actually sort and arrange this. And Aristotle really is a sorting, filing person. He was the first, the plant's first and most obsessive filer. So he got things going. We have William the Conqueror. Any sort of major person, when they came up and set up a palace, or also set up a private zoo. This is not for people, but this is for them to show their guests, to show off their power. So I don't think there was a thought to showing the commoners anything like that. So how did it sort of evolve, sort of creep towards a scientific view? Louis the 14th made a concession that when the animals died in these places, and you can well imagine, I don't know. Look, you can imagine Middle Ages or Enlightenment era would have some sort of basic knowledge, which we'd probably admire to get them alive for so long. But you can imagine these animals dying from time to time, and when the animals died, giving them to the scientists or natural philosophers at the time to have a good examination. There was, basically a king-to-king trading. So these animals were traded across basically bought. Bought across rather than expeditions specifically to go out and capture them, which is a little bit different. There's sort of around this time, earlier, there's a Chinese scientific expedition which actually captures exotic animals and returns them. So I'm just trying to give you sort of all these views of the science viewpoint. So in this particular podcast, I'm going in on one point and actually bringing in all different levels of knowledge which just float into my head. So we have a menagerie, a sort of social menagerie at Versailles, whereas the show diplomatic menagerie for more intense use, where animals fight each other and they're shown, is at another location. The revolution comes and some of these animals escape, and there's a lot of interest as these animals are taken relocated into the centre of Paris in basements. But there's obviously, in this menagerie, you know, the list of animals. Where did the polar bear come from? That's a question I had. And what was happening is that there was sort of a fighting menagerie, a amusement or courtly menagerie, where you would just watch the animals, and certain select guests had sort of certain courtiers basically had the keys to the menagerie to go in and look whenever they wanted to, sort of a diversion. But then again, there's the show of animals to the common people. And these shows were small operations with one or two animals, and the people amused or the terrified people would come and pay a little money to look at it. And it was obviously people had a a career showing it. And so something happened to these shows in Paris, and one wonders whether the establishment which had established the first sort of revolutionary scientific institute to study biology set this out, or it was just natural that in the hard times people believed that these shows were excessive and the interest was excessive, and this is the terror. And if I can say, look, there's again, if you go throughout history, there's been terror upon terror every time basically people run out of food and there's a breakdown of the rule of law, and the ability to denounce people comes in. There's show trials. All the aspects of the terror exist in revolutionary France, in Stalinist Russia, and dare I say, even in little strands of the public service in Australia. You have people, the dissolving of functions, of the proper functions and the ability for people to denounce or have friends, have a, what is it, not quite nepotism, but sort of favouritism and show trials, all these sorts of things. It's in human nature, and it's all there. But in the terror, the spotlight turned on the owners of these animals, and the soldiers basically took the animals into the Jardin des Plantes, and which is the sort of the first natural history museum, which was dedicated to doing lectures to educate the public as a whole, and that was the sort of like the grant application which got it going. And there are reports, and I get conflicting reports of the actual menagerie being sacked and the animals running free, but then you try and read it across, the animals couldn't have made it across to Paris, but they were captured and rehoused. Now, of course, what happened is a lot of this happened in really a short couple of years, because it was 92 when the king got chopped off and Versailles was sacked and ransacked, and you had the animals started to be relocated. They largely died within one or two years due to starvation, because the revolution was in complete chaos. And so that's interesting. One of the amazing stories is the interpretation of, or the relationship with dogs. There was a fairly huge number of dogs in Paris, and there is interest, and I've only read it in one or two accounts, so it's parallel accounts. Look, I'm not a French historian, I wasn't there, so all the best I can do is read various stories and basically follow, in this case, follow the polar bear, follow the different animals through the French Revolution and see what's written there, and you get a general view. But there was a dog in the menagerie. There was a dog which was lived with the lion, and so this was a huge symbolic thing. The lion, this symbol of the king. The dog, I don't know the symbol of dogs. I don't know what the dogs was a symbol of. Probably not peasants. This is probably some sort of working class dog guild. But there was a lot of significance written in it, and so people had a lot of knowledge of these animals, and we're very much aware of the animals. So if you follow the dogs, which is interesting, the dogs are very much pedigree dogs, or hunting dogs, rather than working dogs or mongrels, with a class distinction. Sort of how you kept your dog was to show off. But then Paris was awash with lots and lots of dogs, and it was also awash with a lot of blood of aristocrats, and the dogs had little to eat, and used to eat the blood freely flowing from the guillotines, which created the superstition that a dog having tasted blood would be a danger. So they had large dog, I suppose, I could say they killed lots and lots of dogs. And then One of the things you don't understand, I didn't understand until I followed the dogs, that was counter-revolution. So groups of people saying we're going to rise up and against the uprising. And again, there's lots of blood and dead people, and it was a very bloody time. Lots of dead people and lots of dogs, which became very fierce and ferocious and ate the bodies of a lot of dead people. And there was a lot of shooting of dogs and animals. So it's a bad time for animals all around. However, you get the mix of the intellectual levels of the revolution, the chaos, and a slight mix between the medieval belief in the spiritual power of animals with the arising scientific interest. And, of course, the scientific interest began to really look at the anatomy of animals and to actually start to figure out, they look as though there's some sort of regression here, there's some sort of evolution, common ancestor, so to speak. And, of course, they've got that mechanism wrong, and they've basically found things out in the wrong order. They found out mass extinctions, and this sort of scientific facts, religion and politics all coming into the end, came a very confused world. And it's surprising that Lamarck came up with the insight that a lot of the features seen in animals have been due to evolution. So some super organs, say like smell in dogs, some reduced organs like the legs. How many legs does a whale have? Don't be stupid. Obviously, four legs. There's actually four legs on a whale. These are miniature legs. They're only a few millimeters across, but the people going through the microscopes and things like that. How many gills do you have? Well, the answer is you have gills briefly as you develop as an embryo, and then the gills migrate up into your ears, so you can hear. You hear with your fish gills. All these types of things were crazily going on, mixed with the medieval belief in animals. I think one of the most powerful things I've seen out here in Australia is from the Musée de Cluny from Paris, The Lady and the Unicorn, and you see the way the animals are portrayed, acknowledging royalty. As I say that, an ass cat with a collar has just come around, and that's, again, I hate cats in the Australian bush, but it seems a reasonable thing. It's a bit of a scary thing. It wants to say something to me. Well, cats are another example of our relationships with animals. I suppose one of the things is some of the edicts that are flowing around part of the collection of animals from the streets of Paris, the showmen. Streets of Paris. So there was the fighting menagerie, the social menagerie, the sort of the genteel menagerie, and there's also the common people's menageries, which would go around and travel, and this sort of evolved into the United States, seamlessly evolved into the United States. Oh, look, if I can say, the traveling menagerie has merged with the circus, and so if you see the lions and the elephants are basically from the royal menagerie, to the travelling menagerie. So these proto-circuses were basically raided and brought the different animals into France, or into this museum, which in the turmoil, I don't know whether very many survived. So this is a sort of a background scenery. So often when you hear these facts, I'm going to tell you a bit more about the fantastic Lamarck. The sort of scenery behind it is Obviously, I could describe something, but it's actually much better to give you a conceptual view of, say, an animal and actually track that back. And as you follow it, you follow it back in history, back to Charlemagne and the kings and the Romans and the Greeks and the mythical belief in animals, wrestling with that. You track it back. If it's not one animal, then you track it across to domestic animals like the dogs, which had symbolism with them, and then you track it forward to the Queen's corgis. You see all these features come together, and then the menagerie, which went to zoo, went into our modern scientifically powered zoos, our morally robust zoos, which you have now. We have the less morally robust robust circuses. So there's so much power in the actual description, and as a method to actually fact check, rather than just blandly fact check, oh, was there a polar bear in the middle of Paris? Yes, there appears to be multiple reports, and there appears to be a circumstantial case to explain why there were polar bears there, and how the polar bear got found, and under what thinking a polar bear would be confiscated and removed to a natural history, the basement of a natural history museum. So we're used to stuffed animals, inanimate animals, but this was a real live natural history museum. I can imagine. You knock downstairs in the basement and knock on the door. What's behind that door? And you open. No, you've hit the polar bear. Look, thanks for listening. I hope that has been a focused and a bit more entertaining review. And we'll have to get down into the serious science of this Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck, our soldier. Priest, royal, so you can imagine all these wrong things, who was managed to transform like a chameleon and evolve his own career and rapidly evolve French science through a vehicle which got it through the French Revolution. So there's all these big things, and of course the bottom line is that he came up with pretty much the first fully view of evolution. The mechanism is not quite right, but that's indeed what we should say. He is the originator of evolution, yet his actual mechanism was not right. And historically, although people love to do it, they say, wrong, you lose priority, you got the actual mechanism wrong. So it's all not necessarily wrong when you look at it. There's the evidence that people say that it's wrong is not really sound. Thanks for listening. This is Peter Hill Explains. I hope you keep interest in science, keep studying science, and eventually teach science. Thanks for listening.